David, whether you have a few weeks old puppy or a senior who's seen multiple decades, any dog person like me knows the most valuable thing in the world is spending time with your pet.
Yep.
The farmer's dog makes it easy to keep them healthy, which can give you more quality years with your lovely dog.
Yeah, well, I've heard Farmer's Dog makes and delivers fresh, healthy dog food. And, you know, that's what everyone's looking for. It's recommended by vets, nutritionally balanced. It's made from human-grade ingredients, safe, clean kitchens. All that stuff matters.
Yeah. I mean, you love your dog. Why get the lousy food for your dog? Farmer's Dog is the best. Traditional dry and wet dog food options are extremely processed.
Sometimes
they use
dogs...
much lower quality. Yeah.
you put it in their bowl and they go, what is this kibble? And they knock it away. What is this canned goo?
Oh, yeah. I've had our dog, yeah, look at the bowl and then kind of crank its neck up and look at me. And it was like, really?
They go, really? Why don't you go first? You want a bite of this? Slop?
And it makes that sound.
Here you go, dog.
So Farmer's Dog isn't just higher quality food. They also send the food pre-portioned specifically for your dog based on their unique nutritional needs. It makes it easy to help your dog reach and stay at their ideal weight, David, and which is one of the biggest indicators of a full, healthy life. A fresh diet has been found to have all sorts of benefits, David, from healthier coat and skin, better breath, if you want to kiss your dog, and even easier digestion and smaller and better poops.
Let's look at a clip. It doesn't matter if your dog's young or old, it's always the right time to invest in their health for more happy years with your dog. Get 50% off your first box at farmersdog.com/fly.
Let the Farmer's Dog know we sent you. Use your code or click podcast after you sign up for your first box.
And now for a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends all before you head out the door. Your money's a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Sharon Stone, what can you say? You're going to be listening to her in 22 seconds, depending on how long we go.
You wish. It'll be way longer.
Sharon Stone, just...
did my first movie with the lovely Sharon Stone. She was perfectly wonderful on it. We didn't have a lot of scenes together, but we stayed in the same apartment complex. Every time I see her, I bore the shit out of her with that story. And I thought I saw her at the Oscar at a thing, and I went hunting for her. I wanted to say hi to her. And she's always fun, upbeat, and very much a movie star and sort of kind of old school movie star. Just really pretty from Basic Instinct on, actually from Total Recall on. Always followed what she did.
She's very interesting to talk to. I mean, she mentioned Humphrey Bogart. You know, it was the first time we kind of dove into Humphrey Bogart, the way his suits were tailored. So she meanders in a lot of different directions. Yeah. She's a painter that has shows all over the world. She's been an iconic figure in American cinema. We'll talk a lot about Casino and what's the difference between acting with Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro.
Oh, that's right. There is.
Well, you're not. If you're driving your car, you're going, boy, I'm not pulling over. I'm going to listen to this.
Stick it out. It's great.
She's charming, smart, and quite a delight.
One of the few hosts that took a pee break.
She says, am I allowed to take a pee break? And David said, no. And I said, no, come on.
I said, you're the only host to do it, but let's do it. And she hosted SNL too.
She was such a good sport. And we talk about the comedy that we did in 1992 with Sharon Stone. We would be literally arrested now. So she was a good sport about it. But that was 1992.
You know what? Someone would have come out of the audience and done a citizens cancel. Yeah. Just hold you till the cops come to cancel you.
But she was so good in it.
Yeah.
She said, well, anyway, listen to this podcast. Mm. It's really interesting. I enjoyed it.
Here she is.
Hi.
Long time I haven't seen you. How are you?
I know. Why do you look the same and I look like I belong in an old folks home.
We are getting old, aren't we? It's incredible.
Sharon thought I was Nick Nolte when she jumped on.
That's true. I did.
You do have a Nolte sort of from Prince of Tides, though, or from...
Jesus, Reggie.
You need a little bit more of that shag cut into the top of your hair to be Nick Nolte.
Did you know that Nick Nolte and Mickey Rourke are best friends?
Well, I got to say, they're both unbelievably nice men. I know both of them quite well. I worked with Nick, which was fantastic. I did a movie with Nick and Jeff Bridges. It was wonderful. And then a Sam Shepard film. And then Mickey, I've known forever. I went to Russia with Mickey to help raise money for a children's oncology ward. And Mickey and his best friend went out and got a Santa suit and bought presents for every kid in the ward. And he's just so kind. Mickey's such a kind man.
And so crazy, brilliant. The Wrestler, he did, you know, a few years back. Not the kind of a next level type of acting. Nicolas Cage, you know, in the early days, they all wanted to be friends with Mickey.
Yeah.
So Nicolas Cage wanted to be friends. He'd be like, yeah, I'll come over. And he said that Mickey Rourke would always have him go to like the store on the way over there. Hey, could you give me some orange juice? It's
Nick,
funny.
Nick is so nice. Nick is a fabulous actor too. Wow.
Nicky Nolte, yeah.
No, he's Nick amazing. Cage. He'll make these incredible strange movies, and no matter what he does, they're so fascinating. Pig was fabulous. I don't know if you saw that. It was about
Pig. Yes, I did see it. Ooh. He doesn't believe in realism. I did a movie with him once. He goes, in this next take, I'm gonna do Daniel Day-Lewis from The Name of the Father. But the movie had nothing. It was a comedy, nothing to do with that. So he came in and he just dropped to his knees. Why? He is the most eccentric, the funniest guy ever. But he's got all these cool character parts he's doing lately that are so brilliant. Just quirky movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who was you when you were a little girl? I like to do Oprah stuff. Like, who were the actors or actresses that you went, holy shit, or the movies that you saw?
Yeah. I was obsessed with Humphrey Bogart. He was the greatest, greatest, greatest actor. And he was so cool. And his suit jackets always fit really well. The back of his suit jackets fit really beautifully around his waist and his bum, tailored so beautifully. Like someone knew how to like really fit his clothes. And I thought Spencer Tracy was really so, he had such a great way of expressing his tenderness in a very quiet way. He had such a quality where you really felt like you could trust him somehow. He had something where he let you open up to the characters he played, and I really liked that.
Do you know what's in my wife and I always go by movies you will revisit, and so guess Who's Coming to Dinner? It's become a thing that we see once a year now.
Yeah,
and Spencer Tracy, if you know his speech at the end, you know, just cut you in half to about the love of Sidney Poitier. And, you know,
Sidney Poitier, man, a phenomenal human being. And I had the great joy and pleasure of being friends with Sidney. And, you know, he gave me a lot of advice over the years. And what a good man. Just what a, wow.
Elegant man. Just to watch him walk.
Elegant soul.
Yeah.
The great wisdom about life and a great understanding about life. And
I know. I got to make him laugh once. I did these events for Cedar Sinai Heart stuff, and I would do like my little shtick, and then he stopped me, and I was so nervous to be around him, and I've seen you many times, and he gave me a compliment. So I said, I used to do you. So all I could think of was, they call me Mr. Tibbs, which was 1968 or something.
It's unbelievable in that movie with Rod Stark. Yeah. He was so
in the heat of the night.
Yeah, because, you know, I had the privilege of working with Rod Steiger earlier in my career. And, you know, he was tough. He wasn't fooling around, man. And he put you through your paces on set. I mean, he was a tough dude. And, you know, I'm sure he wasn't easy on Sydney either.
Yeah, whatever chemistry they had, I think it's one of the seminal moments in film history is when, I believe, Sidney Poitier slaps some white Southern guy back.
Yeah, he slaps the sheriff. When the sheriff slaps him, slaps him back.
Yeah, and that was like, whoa.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. Who haven't you worked with?
I haven't worked with some of the, like, I haven't worked with Javier Bardem, who is someone I would like to work with. I haven't worked with a lot of these, like, new directors, and I would really like to do that. I say new, they're probably not so new, but they're new since my spree in the 90s, you know. There's a lot of great young people now that are really exciting, you know.
Who do you think? Shalif Labeef or no, sorry.
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf. I'm sorry. A great actor.
I am. I think Shia LaBeouf is actually very, very talented. And I think
tremendous.
Yes. I think he's really, really intelligent. And I think that his intelligence is probably a bit high for our occupation. And I think that people don't always understand him. I think the opera that he did, the Shia LaBeouf opera, was so brilliant. And that some of these things that he does are probably just a little over the head of some of the people that are looking at him. You know, I had the opportunity to sit next to him one night at an event, and he was just he's a brilliant human being. And I see this with some actors that people don't understand. Sometimes they're just super smart.
Well, like me, but you know, with Shia LaBeouf, I think he comes out in Transformers and people just think he's going to have sort of a cookie cutter situation career that they could predict. And he does something a little beyond that and beyond that every time. And people don't quite get it. And they're like, wait, what are you doing? And he should be allowed to do all that because it's very cool.
Can I ask you both a question? What was the name of the movie where it was about his childhood and his dad was a stage dad? And that's such a heartbreaking movie. And if that is autobiographical, you could see where all his stuff comes
interesting,
from.
Interesting, because I just saw a little clip of Willem Dafoe talking about how all actors are scared. And if they're not scared, they don't give a shit. And frankly, I don't think that's really true. And I think that Shia LaBeouf is one of them that isn't scared. And he also isn't that he doesn't give a shit. I think that he grew up with so much terror that, like, this thing that he does now, expressing the truth of his imagination, is probably the most freeing and lacks such severe consequences that he is able to go beyond some of the things that people who haven't been through what he's been through can ascertain and can get to, you know?
Yeah, he has that quality, like you feel like he needs to do this, you know? Yes. It's medicinal. It's not like just a career.
It's an art, it's his vocation.
Yeah.
Right? And I think for many of us who just keep going, it's because it really is our vocation. Being an artist really is our vocation. It's not just a job, you know? In the beginning, I thought, oh, you're supposed to take all of these parts because, you know, came from a very blue collar family. And I thought, well, that's what jobs are.
Yeah.
You're supposed to just work. I didn't really understand that we were actually allowed to be our whole self as an artist. You know, that's not something that anybody talks to you about when you start becoming an actor, that you should express yourself fully, especially for a woman. They're like, fuck up.
It's personal. It's not like switching jobs at a department store. It's not any complaint. It's a glamorous profession to the outsiders. But when you're in something that really sucks and you know you're going down with the ship, and the bullets, you're out in front of the bullets.
Yes.
And you go to the dailies and you go, oh, this This sucks. It's a horrible
piece and I of always shit. Knew that meant I was going to be the one selling it because all the male cars were going to abandon ship and she was selling this one.
Yeah.
And it would be called Sharon Stone's whatever, like as if it, you were the director, the producer, the writer.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's it's. Did you run into a lot of macho men in the 80s that treated women not very well?
80s
There's
and 90s.
No way.
80s, was 90s, I mean, I yesterday. Don't know. Is Was it
yeah,
piggish men? No, I know. I'm kidding.
I mean, but when I started working, the rules were very different. You know, people were taking their penises out in the makeup trailer and doing coke off the back of the makeup mirrors, and hookers were coming to the set, and drug dealers, and all of that.
A lot of coke, yeah.
You know, you're old enough to remember this stuff.
Oh, I remember. I would hear men in a room talk about women with such contempt together. It kind of shocked me because I had like a rough childhood. I didn't like the way my dad treated my mom and I didn't come from that place. But yeah, there's a lot of anger toward women. It's
yeah.
Like, whoa, where is this coming from?
Yeah.
So you obviously you went through the gauntlet and
took a lot of the brunt of that anger. Because if you're a woman that starts to get any power at all, like shut up, you know.
You started producing, co-producing, production company, you're taking the reins of your career. And
they're like, Sharon, you're doing really well, but we still want you to shut up. Do you understand?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I heard really recently, like as recently as a few weeks ago, a statement about me, which was nobody likes a loudmouth broad.
Did you just think that was about you or was it about
you? It was directly about me. And
oh, Jesus.
Like, you know,
so Harvey Weinstein gave an interview or
from prison?
He hasn't.
And I get it. I get it. I really get it because I am a loudmouth broad. And I get it. I really do understand it.
True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. Now, you're out there, you have acres and acres, hundreds of acres. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. No. Weed control, which you hate, fertilization, aeration.
Huh? Can't stand it.
Among others. They'll do all of that, so you can do literally anything else. Dana's out there like Yellowstone. You have better things to do in your free time. I know you do. You don't want to focus on lawn care.
True Green is too good to be true, is what I'm saying. But it is true, right, David? Because you're going to have more time to do things that you want to focus on.
All the hard work, and it gets you to a great lawn. That's what you want. You take care of everything else you got to do in your life. You're very busy. Let True Green take care of this one thing. Get it off your plate.
You know what? I do have some space. I want to put some grass down. I'll call you later, True Green.
Talk to True Green. Where can listeners purchase or learn more? You go to truegreen.com. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed.
You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour.
Whoa.
They offer a satisfaction guaranteed, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. That is such a cool thing.
Good job, True Green. You're nailing it.
Before you, who tried to take the reins away from the men and who pushed back like you? And you of our generation was probably the first and also was in this spectacular global hit, which gave you so much power. Were there anyone before you that you looked to? Was Katharine Hepburn pretty tough in a way you wouldn't take?
You know, she made her own production company, which was so unheard of. Betty Davis made her own production company, which was really, really unheard of. Lucy, who I actually met and got to put on stage a couple of times early when I was doing events. I got to be the wing person that got to put her on stage. So I met some really interesting people from that old guard and, you know, it was, I mean, it's not nice to say that these women were battle axes. It's a weird expression, but they had paddled their way through. I mean, hardcore battling it. And they wore that battle, you know. It wasn't easily won, anything that any of those women did.
Well, sure. You came through, which is slightly different from, I would say, there as a sex symbol, whatever you want to call it. So when you were exploding, you also were a sex symbol and a mm-hmm. woman. It was a different lane than previous. There might have been other beautiful women, but you were the first that I think played, essentially got a Golden Globe, or it could have been Academy Award nomination, for Basic Instinct, and also being very, very a beautiful young woman. So were you the first in that way to explode in a movie as the co-lead with Michael Douglas?
I think no one was really ready for what happened with that movie. You know, it was tough to make that film. We had a lot of resistance, a lot of resistance in the street, a lot of resistance everywhere. I mean, resistance within. It was a hard movie to get made. It was a hard movie to make. It was a hard movie to finish. My name wasn't even, you know, on the poster. You know, I was not. It was a Michael Douglas movie. It was Michael Douglas in Basic Instinct. And I was on the poster, but not my name, which ultimately worked out to be quite beneficial for me because people were like, who's the girl?
Right.
You know, who's that girl? Jeez, she's all through that movie. Who's that girl? And it
helped. You audition? Did you have to audition a bunch? Who did you beat out?
I auditioned for 8.5 months. And I was the 13th woman that they offered the film to. They didn't offer it to me right away. I had to wait for 13 other more important actresses to turn it down. And many, they really wanted Michelle Pfeiffer. They didn't want me. But she turned it down and they kept going back to her and she kept turning it down, thankfully. And they offered it to just a ton of different people that weren't me. And I just kept hanging in there and I kept screen testing and I kept auditioning for over 8 months.
Wow.
You know, it's smart. You didn't say, fuck this. Now it's getting humiliating. I'm going to walk away. You just stayed.
No, I did that for Casino too. I mean, they saw every showgirl in Vegas. They saw tons and tons and tons of actresses. And by the time Casino came around, I was like, I am not going to line up with showgirls. And I am not going to line up with the other 3,000 actresses. And I finally just said, no, I'm not coming in till you get down to serious casting and I'm done being yanked around in the business. I really want this part and I'm really right for it. And when you get to real casting, let me know.
Wow. I mean, it just so shows you, because you'd done Total Recall before Basic Instinct.
Sure.
You know, and then you've done many other movies. So yeah, just you're always auditioning in Hollywood. It never
wasn't
really
Total
ends.
Recall really big. It can't compete with, I guess, Basic Instinct, but Total Recall, in my recollection, was huge.
It was big and I was famous for a few months and then it kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what happened. It buys you 6 more months in the business.
Yeah. It was like, okay, you did that. And then what? Mm-hmm. But it didn't hold enough power to get me the part in Basic Instinct.
Shit.
Wow. So then here you are in your career. Basic Instinct goes crazy. And then you get a call from Lorne Michaels.
Well, I think Lorne is a wonderful person. I mean, you guys have much closer relationships with him, quite obviously, than I do. But he personally saved my life. You know, I came to do Saturday Night Live with you guys. Which I was so excited to do and scared, really scared. And I came out to do the monologue live, which is always super scary. And a bunch of people started storming the stage saying they were going to kill me during the opening monologue. And the police that are always in there during all that and the security that's always in there froze because they'd never seen anything like that happen. And they sort of, they froze. And Lauren started screaming, "What are you guys doing watching the fucking show?" And Lauren started beating up and pulling these people back from the stage. And the stage manager looked at me and went, "Hold for 5. And I thought he meant 5 minutes. And he meant 5 seconds. And so all these people were getting beat up and handcuffed right in front of me. And we went live. And I was doing this live monologue while they were handcuffing and beating up people at my feet. And if you think the monologue is scary to start with, try doing it while people are saying they're going to kill you and they're handcuffing them while you're doing the monologue.
Can I ask you, were they so mad about? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, when you watch it on YouTube, are you watching the dress monologue or it's actually the one right after the melee when you watch it on YouTube?
It's the melee.
It's surreal. Okay. What were they mad about?
They were mad because it was the beginning of my work as an AIDS field worker and as an AIDS activist. And they didn't understand, nobody understood at that time what was really happening. And they didn't know if AMFAR could be trusted or if we were against gay people or what was, they didn't really know. And so instead of waiting for an informative, intelligent conversation, they just decided, well, we'll just kill her. And it was like, it was very intense. And I went through, you know, a couple of years of really tough times with that until people started to really understand what we were trying to do. And I was so not prepared. And in those days, as you remember, the audience wasn't up like it is now. You literally ran through the audience to make your changes. And so every time we were making a change and you're really physically changing your clothes while you're running through the audience, I was just terrified. I honestly blacked out for half of the show. I knew part. I mean, we did that skit going through the airport security. I'm sure you remember that. And, you know, it's all funny, but I came to for that one. I mean, I came to for like two skits.
I came to.
For most of the show, I was completely blacked out with terror. I didn't even know where I was.
First of all, I mean, as you mentioned this, I remember it, but I must have been getting a wig on or something. But you're saying that Lorne Michaels actually waded in. How many were there? Like 10 people? And they must have been like secret agents. They had to go in very stealthy.
Well, they didn't affect their audience.
I don't know how many there were, or if there were 3 or 5 or something. But it wasn't a huge number of people, but it was enough that Lorne was in there physically trying to contain them himself.
Helping.
And he told me about it at the party. He said it was you know, there was a sucker punch. I
went
got a
leg lock in.
I think that Jen Hooks had a gentleman in a headlock, and then like Sharon landed the monologue.
It was like that. It was so
well
really-
the monologue was great. I watched it this morning, and I want to apologize publicly for the security check sketch where I played an Indian man and were convincing Sharon, her character or whatever, to take her clothes off to go through the security thing. Rob
so
Schneider.
Offensive.
Just want to, it's so 1992. It's from another era.
I feel very, I don't have as many, I know the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony. And I think that we were all committing misdemeanors because we didn't think that there was something wrong then. We didn't have this sense. I had much bigger problems than that. You know what I mean? That was funny to me. I didn't care. I was fine being the butt of the joke. But I feel like now we're in such a weird and precious time because people have spent too much time alone. Mm-hmm. People don't know how to be funny and intimate or any of these things with each other. Mm-hmm. And everybody's so afraid that they're putting up such barriers around everything that people can't be normal with each other anymore. It's lost all sense of reason. We need real laws so that we know what's a felony, what's a misdemeanor, and what's an offense to me. Mm-hmm. And you can say, I'm offended. No, that's against the law. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to know. And the fact that we don't know has a lot of people who shouldn't be making up things, making them up.
Well, as a comedian, you do self-censor yourself. Or if you're sitting around with friends and you're kind of laughing, thinking of stuff, you go, well, you can't say that, or you can't say that, or you can't do that. You just automatically get into that zone where, you know, obviously for me, when I was doing the Indian character, and I actually have an Indian cardiologist who's famous, and whenever I do events for him, he wants me to do him. there was no malice in it. There was no sense of, it was really me rhythmically trying to get laughs. So I just want to say that watching it, it is, comedy needs a straight person, and you were perfect in it. You were completely sincere, and you made us funny because you're like, oh, come on, guys, really? Mm-hmm. And then, all right, but this is the last one. So the idea that you were blacked out in that, you know, but
no, she woke up for that one.
Oh, you woke up for that one.
I usually woke up when people start asking me to take my clothes off. I have a tendency to wake up for that.
These buzzwords, take off your blouse. Yeah. Yeah. That whole show was really fun. Pearl Jam.
Oh my God.
I remember I just started and we were looking forward to going, oh my God, Sharon Stone and Pearl Jam coming up.
Can you imagine what a beautiful, I mean, that's a beautiful memory.
Well, we all loved hanging out with you. And you had a wing woman who was incredibly nice too. I'm sorry, I forget her name. Probably your best friend, but she was there all week too.
Mimi.
Excuse me?
Mimi.
Yeah. Who's incredibly nice. And the two of you were so charming and nice. And it was just fun. It was a fun show for me. Having you out there, and I don't know, just I thought you were great.
Oh, it's really fun. I'd love to do it again. You know, Lauren always says, oh, you're welcome back anytime, because I think that he wants to make it up to me that I can come on the show and no one will try to kill me.
We've had death squads before, but Sharon was the first. I think that we love Lauren, but you can't. Lauren is a singularity of a human being and with a gigantic brain and a gigantic heart, but we can't not do him because he's so fun to inhabit that attitude. David, did you have something to say?
I was just saying that early in my days when I was 21, I did my first movie with Sharon, and she had a part in it, and she couldn't have been more stunning, and I couldn't have been more starstruck, and she wasn't even a star. And she was so lovely on it. I was a skateboarder in it. And two things I remember from that movie. Sharon was in my same apartment complex where they put us up. And when she was wrapped a little earlier than me, she gave me all her stuff from her apartment in her fridge, which I took. Because I blew all my per diem at the strip club. And then this is in Toronto. And then the other thing I remember is when I was at the wrap party, I thirstily went to the wrap party. And I went and I had a headache before I went. So I went and bought their version of Tylenol, which is 2 22s, which are just all codeine. It's like taking 4 Vicodin. So I started feeling better at the party. Then I said, I think I'm going to go home. Then I said, I think I'm going to sprint home. And it was about 3 miles. Then I was going to dig a pool. And then I was just running around Toronto all night because I didn't know why I was so wired. And I didn't put together that they're over-the-counter codeine,
yep.
Which is why I want to move back. That's a long story.
I think I still have a bottle of that in my medicine cabinet.
Oh my God, it was so great. I couldn't believe it. Then I was like, oh wait, I'm going to be the first one to get addicted. That'll be my goal. But anyway, Sharon was lovely. And then when she came on SNL, it was very fun for me because I was just a new writer. But I thought she went up on a rocket ship and she was doing great. And she was perfectly sweet to everyone there. For being that level of craziness, like you can't even imagine that whirlwind, and then just had a real fun week with us.
I went home, and when I got in the airport, Mimi went to get the luggage so I could go and get in the limo. And while she was gone, these two, there used to be a guy called the Kamikaze Paparazzi, and he and his friend, they dove, the limo driver got out to put the bags in the back of the car. And they dove in the front of the driver's seat and started screaming like they were like warriors on crack or something, and were coming through the space to the back seat. taking pictures of me while they were screaming at the top of their lungs. It was so crazy. And the driver had to pull them out and he started beating them up to get them out of the car. And then we got
the old
car
days.
And we started down the freeway and they started behind us and they kept hitting the limo with their car. They kept rear-ending us and sideswiping us. And it was so terrifying. And I got the police on the phone and the police are like, well, stop the car because we don't know which town from the airport to my house you're in. And I'm like, I'm not going to stop the car. They keep hitting me. They're hitting me. I'm terrified to stop the car because I don't know what they'll do to me. And they're like, well, we don't know how to help you because you're moving. You're a moving target. And I'm like, I think you better get a helicopter because they're ramming the shit out of our car.
And that used to be legal.
You know? And I think now about these young superstars like Taylor Swift and stuff. Like, how did she get from one place to the next safely?
I think that there's a lot of security that's never discussed because it has to be a small army and very stealthy. It has to be 24/7.
But you know, when this happened to me, the studios weren't going to pay me more money and they weren't going to pay for an army of security. And I didn't make the money to pay for it myself because they weren't paying women. And it was a freaking nightmare. I mean, helicopters in my backyard and just fucking craziness. And no one seemed to think there was a reason to give me the money to take care of myself. And yet there was a reason to keep pushing me out there.
Are you catching the big game or making big mods, going on that first date or installing that first brake kit? Binging that new show or watching install videos? When you're a real car lover, the choice is obvious. eBay Motors has you covered with over 122 million parts to fit your number one ride or die.
Brake kits, turbochargers, LED headlights, exhaust kits, bumpers, roof racks, and engines. Whether you're into the speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has all the parts you need for the ride you love. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time. Or your money back. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Reality TV has hit a new high on Hulu. From executive producer Jimmy Kimmel, the all-new Hulu original series High Hopes is finally here for your viewing pleasure.
The Hulu original reality series follows two budding entrepreneur brothers and their hilarious half-baked employees at one of the fastest-growing cannabis dispensaries in Hollywood. This workplace comedy showcases the highs and even more highs of the competitive marijuana industry.
More than just coworkers, the owners and bud tenders in High Hopes are one dope family.
You'll fall in love with these quirky characters as they pursue career aspirations, love, and fame, all under a slightly hazy cloud.
All episodes of the new reality series High Hopes are now streaming only on Hulu.
Were you dating back then? Or were you married? That's another thing. It's hard to keep secret.
I was dating, not during Basic Instinct, but I met my boyfriend at the time, Bob Wagner, on The Quick and the Dead, and we were together for several years, which was very helpful. Hmm. Very helpful.
Oh, we had one question. We don't know. This is an actor question. Why is Michael Douglas so good at playing guilty, horny men who are succumbing to seductive women? Fatal Attraction, Basic Instinct, and Disclosure. What is the secret sauce? Because no one looks more guilty than Michael. But you two were great in the Basic Instinct.
Now,
you're being
a smart person. And I think he really knows what works and what will work and what won't work. And he's a fantastic producer, you know, and he's also a fantastic activist. He really has a sense of the world and how it works and what's happening and what isn't happening. And I think he picks projects that he knows how to handle and how to make them work and how to make them sell. And I think he said to me when I came on to do the show, he said, you got the best part. The villain is the best part. You can because you don't have to follow any rules at all. You can do whatever you want. You can play it the way you feel like it, and you can do anything at any time, because a villain doesn't have to be consistent or dependable in any way. You can just do anything at any time, and you don't have to explain why you're doing it. And I think it's a really good hook on that. So when he plays the unlikable person, he just lets it go.
Well, Well, you two were so good together in that. And
he's great also. He's great.
I think it's Verhoeven.
He's falling down.
Really, you know, Verhoeven's a fantastic director. And he's not afraid of the perverse or the kinky or the strange. You know, he just really not afraid.
Yeah, Basic Instinct goes some places that are definitely, at that time, or maybe even today, just interesting, psychosocial, not even sexual, but just sort of people that are damaged or whatever you want to call it.
No, like when he did RoboCop and he had the robot screen turn off, it was the first time that a movie went black, to see how long an audience could sit in the theater with a black screen and have it be meaningful and have the audience consume that empty space as part of their own journey. I mean, he takes a lot of risks, and, you know, I think it might have been, I don't know, but another one of his movies where he started using humans as a bullet shield, and no one had done that before, and it was considered so out there, you know. And we look at what we see now, you know, it's so nothing.
We've come a long way. It's great.
Did you?
Okay. Don't underestimate the perversiveness of America. That's the big lesson. There's they always want
it's a lesson now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nothing like a human shield.
I have a question for her.
It absorbs
Dana.
The bullets. I have a question too. You go ahead.
Okay, you go. Okay. Well, the quick one is: Margot Robbie is sort of in your situation now. Would Barbie be something that you would have been interested in? Is that up your alley? That kind of movie.
I went to the studio to try to make Barbie in the '90s.
Bingo.
With a producer friend of mine, and I had. I guess he was the CEO of Mattel on our side. And we got thrown out of the studio. They were like, why would you take this American icon and want to destroy it? Like, what is wrong with you? I mean, I got a lecture and an escort to the door.
Do you run into them, today and just go, guys,
oh, they're
I
not,
told you.
They're not there anymore.
Okay.
But I think, you know, if they're still alive, they probably think, oh, I hate her.
What kind of angle would you take on a Barbie back then? I wouldn't even think of what to do.
Well, I mean, we had it so that the opening scene would be Barbie pulling up to Mattel in her Barbie car, and then Secret Service come out and their feet are as big as the car. And they escort her into Mattel, and everybody just falls aside because she's the most important member of Mattel, and how all the big people are chasing her around and kissing her ass because she's the queen of Mattel, and about the power of being Barbie and what Barbie could do in the world because she was so powerful. But
Barbie, you were ahead of your time.
No, they didn't think Barbie should be powerful.
The men were behind the times then.
Keep Barbie in the dream car or whatever.
Yeah, in her Barbie dream car.
Yeah, keep her quiet, yeah.
And Ken. So The Quick and the Dead, which is a movie, I love Westerns. Gene Hackman, Russell Crowe, before he was Russell Crowe. You were a producer on the movie. Mm-hmm. I know you fought for him. And then Leonardo DiCaprio as a fetus. He's like 15 or something.
17. He turned
17.
18 on our movie.
And didn't you insist on him or pay his salary? I don't know. I read stuff that about your relationship with those two actors, Russell Crowe and Leonardo DiCaprio.
I really did believe in both of them. I felt that both of them were sort of teed up to become major stars. I thought they were both very unusually talented and in specific ways. And, you know, there's a pattern in filmmaking, right? And I thought that Russell was like the Richard Burton of his time, that he was you know, that actor who could play, you know, the captain of a ship, the, you know, he had that heavy masculinity. And that was sort of fading out in that period when we had, oh, I think there was a name for it then. It was different. It was like men were kind of, I don't know, there was a name for it where men could be.
Metrosexuals.
Oh, that's what it was. Metrosexual. Oh. And Russell was certainly not metrosexual. Russell was very, you know, old school man. And I felt there was a place for that in our industry. I felt this way about Ken Watanabe, that he was a big place for him in film. And, you know, I see different actors and I think, oh, you've really got it. Mm. I just met a guy named Aaron Pierre, and I feel certain that this guy, Aaron Pierre, is going to be a gigantic star. Just gigantic. I think he's just going to explode in stardom.
What is his type? What does he look like? Is he a Russell Crowe or is he a...
He just has played Malcolm X in the upcoming limited series about Malcolm X.
Oh, okay.
And he's a big, kind of strong looking, just a beautiful elocution. He's got a certain way about him. He carries something that just... to me, screams stardom. I think he's really going to be just a huge star. Huge.
Okay. We will have you back on our podcast in a year.
We'll track it.
And we're gonna talk all about that guy. One thing about Russell Crowe I just wanted to say is, because I do voices, he has a next level deep voice and a big deep voice. And one of my favorite movies, I don't know if you guys have seen it, Master and Commander, that Peter Weir did with Russell Crowe playing the commander.
Twice shot guns.
And it's really hard to do him because he's like Obama. It's a tonally. Mm-hmm. But Leonardo just, obviously, he's just aged into this incredible actor. And he looks so, so young in The Quick and the Dead. And he was. But boy, is he great.
But he was so infested. And he was so able to access his vulnerability. And the other kids that came in were really good. I mean, Matt Damon came in for the part and he was so good, so good.
Yeah, he's a stud.
But Leo came in and he cried when his father rejected him, when Gene Hackman rejected him. Leo was the only one that cried and wanted his dad to notice him and care about him. And he was trying so hard to be enough of a man that his father would pay attention to him, which was really the crux of the character and the crux of the development. And when he was going to die and couldn't get it, he just, you know, he was crying for his father's attention and affection. And it was so profoundly moving and so brave for a 17-year-old kid to come in on an audition and let that out. And I just thought, that kid has a lot going on and he is going a long ways, because not any other person came in, and we saw everybody in the town, not anybody else that came in was willing to just rip it open like that. And that's why I stood up for him, because I thought, you know, you have a kind of guts in your vulnerability that is what makes a star. And that combination of intense courage with your own vulnerability is so rare. And he just has it in spades. I mean, that's why you see him in The Wolf of Wall Street and he just lets it rip. You know, and he's not embarrassed or ashamed or pulling his punches, you know, and that's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. He's a good movie star, you know, and you were saying Sidney Poitier earlier. I was wondering, I'm sure there are, but it doesn't seem like there's as many of those old school, elegant, great looking, cool movie stars like there used to be. There probably is. But I think when you grow up with a certain ones that you look up to, it feels like it's thinning a bit.
Yeah, I think this kid, he doesn't look like a kid, but he is young. This Aaron Pierre has that. I think he has that elegance. And you're right, it is so rare because for some reason, young people seem to have this kind of disregard and disrespect for the way they appear in public and the way they treat the press, as though the press isn't your sole liaison to the public. It's like, get a clue. If they don't want to shoot you and they don't want to support you and they don't want to believe in your films, you should probably leave town.
Love the idea of leaving town still.
You know, get out of town.
With all our connectivity. Can we talk about Casino for a second? Because I was talking to my wife about that. She goes, oh my God, Sharon was so brilliant in that movie.
God damn.
Because I guess it's the actress meets the part, meets the director, meets De Niro, meets Pesci. And that was magic in that role.
It was my dream. My whole dream was to work with Robert De Niro. My acting teacher is like, what do you really want out of this? And I'm like, I want to work opposite Robert De Niro and hold my own. I mean, that was the whole sentence. That was the whole thing. That's really all I ever wanted. And I got it. I didn't expect I was going to get to work with Martin Scorsese. You know, Jesus, who does, you know? And to have had this astonishing opportunity and to get to do it, you know, I wasn't going to leave anything on the floor.
You didn't.
You did not.
What's De Niro like? Like, you're in a scene with him between takes, just casual. I just love to know, like, does he change it a lot? Does he surprise you? What's it like? You're just doing a scene with De Niro. Scorsese's
he doesn't
there.
Mess around on set. He doesn't small talk. He doesn't hang out. He doesn't have anything else to talk to you about other than the work of the day. Nothing. Absolutely nothing else. And he might give me a suggestion, but he doesn't tell me how to do my job. He might say, you know, in the middle of that thing you're doing, could you just give me a glance here at some point? Or do you need something here from me? Or is this what you, are you wanting this? You know, he's very, very connected to the work, the outcome, what you're doing. He's just absolutely the most dedicated, devoted. Watching him work, I learned more than I learned watching any other actor. And I got to work with, like, George C. Scott. I mean, I worked with some really wow. cool actors, you know what I mean? But De Niro is, you know, he's just like his own thing, man. You know, he's not a chit chatter. He's just really is serious. And that's the reason I think he's so good.
And what about Pesci?
Joe Pesci really fought for me. You know, he fought for me to get the part. He believed in me, stood up for me. He's really good to me. I really appreciate him so much. He was really supportive of me. He absolutely believed in me in a way that I don't think anybody else really did. And, you know, we had rough scenes to shoot, you know, like, because our relationship was rough sex and dirty and secret. And I felt completely safe with him, although, you know, when he's in that character, he's scary as all, you know, he's all in. And it's good to work with someone that's all in. But, you know, Joey played in that film just a, you know, really, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but like loose, ready to go, ready to kill somebody at any second. Mm. And, you know, I'm playing someone who's choking me in bed and I'm trying to be loose with all this, you know.
Right.
You know, it was intense and great intense, but, you know, you got to belly up to the bar when you go to work with Jimmy Woods and Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro. There's no fucking around.
You better be good. You got to hold your own.
You better be present. And I think that those people often scare actresses. I've watched many, many other actresses work. And while they're sometimes quite good, often they seem a bit defended. And I think that you have to really not be separate from those guys. You have to be willing to jump in the pool with them and know that they're not going to save you if you're drowning.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/wall to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/wall. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
I had to learn...
Hey, ¿qué pasa? ¿Qué pasa?
Is that what they say when you walk into sushi?
I think that's what's happening in Spanish. ¿Qué pasa? ¿Qué pasa? David Ospero.
I had a difficulty learning German in high school. It's a very tough language. I did it through textbooks and a teacher. I would have rather had Rosetta Stone.
You know, you not being able to learn German is very, very interesting.
But stupid.
But stupid.
Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program. We know this. Available on desktop as an app. Truly immerses you in the language you want to learn.
Yeah, this is planning a trip to Italy. And I think Rosetta Stone is my ticket to speak a better language.
Hey,
I want a pizza pie. But I'll be saying it in Italian. Hey, I want a pizza pie. Sounds like
that's better
English, but it's still, that was
they
Italian.
Say, do you want to sound perfectly fluent or do you want to sound like Ratatouille?
Honestly, trusted experts for 30 years, David, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. You want to hear some?
Yeah, the
Spanish,
big ones.
Spanish, French, Italiano, Sturman, Korean, Chinese, Javanese,
careful,
Dutch, Arabic, Polish.
Fast language acquisitions. Rosetta Stone.
Should I read that straight?
It immerses you in many ways. No English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and you think in the language, Dana. That's
yes.
The hard part.
No, I do like their process. The intuitive process picks up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's designed for long-term retention, David, because we all took Spanish in high school, and all we can say is donde está la biblioteca.
Yeah.
I can find a library, but nothing else. Rosetta Stone is a game changer.
It's like having
David.
A personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. We said the desktop, the app options, audio companion. You can do it offline. It's amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages. For any and all trips and language needs in life, that's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off. That is a steal. I'll say that in English, a steal.
Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Fly on the Wall listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off.
Visit rosettastone.com/fly. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/fly today.
Before we let you get on with your life, I just wanted to kind of mention your book, your autobiography, which got rave reviews. Do you want to talk to it a little bit? And then also your art. And right now you're in Berlin in a gallery, I believe. your art has been well received by critics. You've been interviewed in New York by Jerry Stass or whatever. So
Jerry Saltz.
How did that happen? And what are you they're big, beautiful, colorful abstracts. Are they in acrylic or oil or a combo? And do you have someone helping you bring in canvases and stretch them and gesso them? And there's a industrial part of having a studio. And how did you work toward being able to do that? Or you'd done some art before, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, you know, I studied all this at university where, you know, if you studied art, you had to do everything from jewelry making to sculpting to oils, watercolors, acrylic. You had to do everything. Mm-hmm. So I know how to do all that, but there's certain aspects of it I just don't want to do anymore. So I get my canvases stretched for me and I get them built elsewhere. Because it's mm-hmm. just, it's too much for me at this point.
Yeah.
But I do have a studio manager who is really cool named Zach, and he's terrific and he helps me a lot. But basically, I mean, painting is sort of a one man band and you've got to just, it takes time. It takes time and dedication and devotion, and it's an on-the-job learning process. And the more you paint, the better you get, and the more you understand, and the more you study, the more you understand how to mix colors, and the more you understand how color works. I'm fascinated by color. And the more you understand balance and story and execution and the use of all the different possible tools that you can use, it's like anything. The more you mm-hmm. do it, the better you get.
And do you work on multiple canvases at a time, or do you kind of one at a time?
Yes, I do. I work on Ooh. Canvas till I feel that it's at the point where I'm as far as I can go. And sometimes I complete a canvas, and sometimes I think that's the underpainting. And I need to just put that in the other room for now until mm-hmm. I understand where I'm going from here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that totally makes sense.
Right. Cause you guys probably write like that, right?
Yeah. And Dana paints also.
Well, I'm not like you, but I was surprised how much I loved it. And I have no ability at all. I would just do doodles and little characters on yellow pads, right? And then I saw Basquiat and I go, oh, well, I'll do my version of that. So I do them on heavy paper, 30 by 32. And then sometimes I blow them up and they're just acrylic so I can go fast. I don't want to think too much. And I often overpaint them.
I think overpainting is smart and good. I overpaint constantly. I think you don't want to waste anything. And when you know it's not working, overpaint it or overpaint part of it. Which is what I'm coming to understand now is that when you do something and you think, oh, that's just awful, don't just overpaint the whole thing right away. Like, give yourself a minute to really step back from it and find one good thing in it and start mm-hmm. overpainting, but leave the good thing. And before you overpaint it, make sure you turn it every single direction. Turn it upside down, turn it sideways, look at it from every direction, because you don't know where your inspiration is coming from. And, mm-hmm. and I agree. I think Basquiat is just the unbelievable talent. And mm-hmm. he also showed us another way to be, another way to express ourselves, another opportunity.
You know, you'd look at it and you go, why is it affecting me so much? When you go to an art museum and you're going around the corner, you see a big Basquiat. You go, people, you can't dismiss it. There's something so fluid about it, so casual, this feeling of just being connected to the canvas. I don't know. It's just talent, I guess, but he's fun. Who else do you like?
Well, you know, with this Rothko show that has been going on, and then if you follow the show, then mm-hmm. you start getting your daily Rothko, and you look at these colors and you think, the same thing. Why is this having such a tremendous impact on me? And how mm-hmm. did he do it? And why? And what does it mean? And it just evokes so much. And, you know, I feel this way. I'm a huge Gerard Richter fan. And I just love these paintings and the impact and movement of these paintings. And, you know, Helen Frankenthal, the color aspect of what she did was so mm-hmm. moving and interesting, and the way she did it was all her own. And I just, you know, I just I don't know. I'm a little bit of an artaholic. I've spent most of my life on the road in museums on my day off. And that's been a fantastic education.
Well, it's cool. You've been, it's a little bit like any kind of personal pursuit. Like, time really flies if you're really focused on a painting, whether you're a novice or great. It's a meditation. And you've been really well received. So I'm going to make a prediction about you, whether you want it or not, but there's going to be some role or live streaming Apple show or something you're going to be in and be brilliant. If you feel like you want that, because I can just tell talking to you, put a camera on this woman because you have all this energy and all this emotion. It's all right there. So that's my prediction. You have yours. David, would you like to make a prediction?
I think it's wonderful talking to Sharon. She's so articulate and so exactly as I remember. And she's got such a voice that is very unique and well-known. And voices never change with people. It's always, you know, you get older, people go on their lives, and it's always, there's something interesting about somebody's voice. It's like a fingerprint. I like hearing Sharon's voice. I like hearing all she has to say today, and very cool of her to talk to us.
Thank you for coming on, Sharon. Really, really enjoyed it. Wish you all the best.
I was so excited that you asked me to come on. First, because I haven't seen either one of you in quite a while, and it's just good to see you both. And it's good to see you both well and good. And yeah. It's good to see that, you know, we're all still standing. You know, we devoted ourselves and agreed to do this. And, you know, it's hard to hold on. You have to really want it. It has to be everything to you to hold on. And it's really nice to see that we're all still surviving together. So I just really appreciate that you took your time and invited me into your world. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon.
All right, Sharon, we'll talk to you soon. And thank you and have a great day. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please follow, subscribe, leave a like, a review, all the stuff, smash that button, whatever it is, wherever you get your podcasts. Fly on the Wall is executive produced by Dana Carvey and David Spade, Jenna Weiss-Berman of Odyssey, Charlie Finan of Brillstein Entertainment, and Heather Santoro. The show's lead producer is Greg Holtzman.